Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Greg Plank, and I represent Travelers in this case. This case is about a workers' compensation subrogation lien, and then the how to divide third-party tortfeasor insurance proceeds. This is a case where the county court was acting as the probate court. There was a wrongful death settlement. It was for the policy limits of $1 million, and it was split up because there was the injured or the deceased worker, and then there was a passenger, and each got half of $1 million. And then the half that was for the deceased worker, half of that went to the spouse, and then the other half went to two adult children. We're only talking about the portion that went to the spouse, because that's the only part that the lien applies to. So this case, we believe there was, after we all agreed to take the $1 million policy, then we agreed to the distribution of, and there was $250,000. And then we had a fairness hearing because we weren't able to decide how to divide up those proceeds. And
the spouse's proceeds.
The spouse's proceeds, correct, Your Honor. So we had that, and that's where we believe the district or the court of the county court abused its discretion in awarding the entire amount to the deceased widow's spouse, and then denying Travelers any future credits in this. The analysis that the court had was basically that the widow's damages, I believe he basically indicated, while not saying it per se, is if they had a higher priority or made whole, and they were a higher priority than the comp lien, which is an impermissible under Turco, Sterner, and that line of cases.
But didn't he also say that the Travelers had charged and received necessary premiums to provide the workers' compensation coverage?
Yes,
and,
Judge, but...
And under all of the circumstances, the Travelers' financial risk was minimal, and insurance companies are in the business of assuming the risk?
That's ignoring the statutory scheme. The Work Comp Act is construed to be in favor of work employers having a statutory right to subrogate in these situations, to shift the liability or the burden upon the third-party tortfeasor, not on the employer. So if you agree with that, if you agree with the court on that, you're basically undercutting what the act is talking about in subrogation.
I
understand. I meant the
whoever would make the decision.
Yes, whoever. Correct. But I think that the act is clear. The reason we have subrogation is in order to keep premiums and premiums down. It allows the insurance companies to go after or to get a recovery on these things.
As I understand it, it used to be that if you expended funds under the workers' comp statute and there was a settlement by a third-party tortfeasor, you automatically had the right to come in and subrogate. And it was changed then to this fair and equitable division by the trial court.
That's correct. That was, and then Turco talked about this made whole portion of the case.
And so it's an abuse of discretion, is that correct?
With regard, we got two different pieces rolling here. We got the third party proceeds, and that's an abuse of discretion, whether or not his division whether he did that. That's an abuse of discretion. The other issue we have is the future credits. And the future credits, I'm arguing that you have to review the statute. The statute requires them to give Travelers the future credit for any third-party proceeds that are given to the spouse or an injured worker.
So it's your interpretation that that's required.
Correct.
That is not a decision that the trial court can make.
I believe so. I think he needed to give Travelers, say if he's going to give all the third-party proceeds to the widow, then he has to say, but I'm giving a future credit, so you have a holiday until that amount is expended.
And what portion of the statute do you think holds that? Says that?
It is the second paragraph of 48.118, I believe. Any recovery by the employer against such third person in excess of the compensation paid by the employer after deducting expenses making the recovery shall be paid forthwith to the employee dependents and shall be treated as an advance payment by the employer on account of future installments of compensation.
Thank you.
Now, the other thing the court did in attempting to bolster its decision is saying that the travelers or the lien holder did nothing to prosecute the subrogation lien. That
the court didn't really say that. The court said there wasn't any evidence that she'd done.
Well, and there wasn't any evidence because we can't. We're not allowed to do that under the statutes. I think it's 48.118.1 requires if either party's going to file litigation, they have to notify the other party, and then both parties can proceed, and they have to act. They have an equal voice in any lawsuit. So our hands are tied on that matter. So in this case, there wasn't a litigation. There wasn't a lawsuit filed. The $1 million proceeds were tendered, you know, to the there was an agreement with both estates to take that money, and Travelers agreed to it as well. So I think that that's inappropriate for the court to say that. In addition, Judge Imbati, I think that there's cases out there. Well, the Burns case says that you can't say, you can't use equitable defenses such as unclean hands in order to punish the lien holder and say they're not entitled to anything. Burns says that you're supposed to do, that the court is only supposed to make a reasonable distribution of the money.
Counsel, the documents that you're talking about where Travelers would have signed off approving the settlement for the $1 million, was that document offered into evidence? Because I don't remember seeing that.
I think that was the when they applied, they did the petition for approval of the settlement and gave notice to all the parties is what I'm referring to. There was notice. We all agreed to the settlement, but no, it's not evidence for the hearing. Well, that's how we got to that.
I understand.
So that's.
I just wanted to clean up that one little part of it to make sure that I hadn't missed something.
Okay. I think it's part of the record that you have.
Right. I understand what you're saying.
Now, the more important, I think, part of this is that the court failed to determine future credits as a result of the third-party settlement. The statute, as we talked about before, indicates that those proceeds are to be treated as advance payment on account of a future installment for compensation. Travelers would step into the shoes of the employer with that regard, and there's cases out there, the Nikita, I believe, if I pronounce it correctly, that's another case involving benefits, death benefits to a widow. And then there's Turner and Thomas. Those cases all basically indicate that if the injured worker's heir receives the third-party benefit proceeds, then the work comp carriers to get a credit for those. The statute 48.118 has not been modified. I think appellant argues that, well, at the fairness hearing, the judge can make the determination, but that's a different statute. And that statute indicates that he's supposed to make a fair and equitable distribution of the proceeds, not determine. It doesn't say anything about future credits. So, therefore, based upon the arguments presented, Travelers would request that this court overturn the trial court's order, remand the case with directions to make a fair and equitable distribution of the proceeds, and award Travelers a future credit to the extent the heir receives a third-party tortfeasor settlement.
Can you remind me, did the county court order talk about the future credits at all?
No, it was silent with regard to the future credits.
So it just said, this is the fair and equitable distribution.
Right.
But didn't address the issue of the future credits.
Correct.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
My name is Kevin O'Donnell. I represent the appellee, and basically I represent the widow, Darla Evertson, in this matter. Now, this matter was brought before the county court under Section 30-810, which is the wrongful death statute. It is a creature of statute, wrongful death actions did not exist at common law. They became part of our statutory scheme in 1873 based on Lord Campbell's Act. It's an exclusive remedy for the widow or widower and next of kin. It's not based on the employee-employer relationship under Section 48. As a matter of fact, in reading the statute, it says it's for the exclusive benefit of the widow or widower and next of kin. It goes on to say, such amount shall not be subject to any claims against the estate of such decedent. That's in 30-810. When you read the cases that have been referred to, all of these cases are injury cases where the claims were that of the employee, not the widow. The cases that are referenced here, there was no pain and suffering. This automobile accident, there's no dispute, instantly killed. It's an exclusive remedy for the widow or widower. So the big question is there in fact a subrogation lien against those provisions? Because that's where our recovery is at with regard to this. It's under 30-810. And in terms of fair and equitable distribution, and in looking at the case law that both has that the decisions of both this court and the Supreme Court, they never got involved with the result. They got involved with the process. In other words, you can't use common law equity theories on this thing. It's a matter of statute. I think what they were trying to say is that we're concerned about the process, not about the result. And to make an analogy, it's like, you know, teeing off. You know, you go out there and you find out your ball's out of bounds. You come back, you start all over again. And so the way I read these cases in terms of what's been ruled on before, because other than saying go make a fair and equitable distribution, there really isn't any direction on how you do that or what the court said. It said you can't do it this way, you can't do it that way. What counsel is referring to here, he's implying theories to be used, but the court specifically did not use any of these theories in terms of coming to its decision. It simply looked at the facts and the evidence that was presented before the court and made a ruling that it felt was fair and equitable. The standard is abuse of discretion, and as this court has said on many occasions, that means that you have no tenable reasons for how you decided things. I think you have a tenable reason here, given the fact that you have a death, you have a widow, and the court, in looking at all the circumstances and the evidence that was presented, said this is what a fair and equitable division or distribution should be. Simple as that.
Do you agree the court didn't address the claim for credit for future payments?
Well, it didn't, but the argument was made with regard to the future credit, so it had it before it in terms of knowing that that was an available remedy, and it chose to not do it.
But isn't that portion of the statute worded as mandatory using the word shall?
Well, again, I go back to this question of whether or not it even applies to the widow's benefits based on 30-810. It says exclusive to her, and in terms of the language again, it says any amount shall not be subject to the claims against the estate of such decedent. So I think maybe you've got a conflict there.
Well, doesn't claims against the decedent, though, really refer to the, you know, claims of creditors and so forth that set forth in the probate statute?
The subrogation lien would be filed against the estate of the decedent.
You don't have any case law authority for that position?
I'm just common sense. It was filed in here. That's how we got to where we're at in terms of this lawsuit.
This was part of the probate proceeding.
Part of the probate proceeding.
So if we take your argument to its extension, then the court wouldn't even have to say it's a fair and equitable distribution because that's under Chapter 48.
Exactly.
You're saying we just look at the probate statute.
Well, I'm looking at the exact language. It's a statute. It's statutory law, strictly construed, and I don't think there's any cases out there that really have ever addressed this, but we're raising it in front of you. Any questions?
We don't have any further.
Thank you.
How much time does the appellant have remaining?
He is over.
You're over. So
I'm
none.
Sorry.
I have a question.
But, excuse me, we do have a question for you, counsel, so if you wouldn't mind remaining for an extra minute.
The cases that you have been citing or the theories that you've been citing for that being able to get the subrogation for the future credits?
Yes.
Those all deal with the worker itself, not the estate, isn't that correct?
No. Nikuda is versus Waspy Trucking. That is a widow case.
Do you have that site?
I'd also point out that the...
Excuse me, do you have that site?
Yes.
Or is it in your brief?
It is in my brief as well, Judge. Site is 222 NEB 806.
Thank you.
And I'd also point out that the statute 48118 talks about when a third person is liable to employee or dependents for the injury or death of employees. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll give you a minute to respond to that if you wish, Mr. O'Donnell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Nikuda was decided in 1986 before 48118-04 was adopted by the Nebraska legislature, about 10 years before. I just point that out to you, where the fair and equitable distribution was put into the statute.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate you being here and traveling and wish you safe travels home, and your case is submitted. You are excused. Thank you.
Thank you.